is VOA News. I'm Steve Norman reporting. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was proclaimed the winner early today of Sunday's election that ushers in a governmental system granting the president sweeping new powers. Some people have complained the election was rigged. Observers such as the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe were on hand. The leader of the OSCE mission, Ignacio Sanchez Amor, says he heard a Turkish news agency portraying the OSCE mission as biased.
We are very disappointed because I think they are trying to portray us and to dismiss our work, and we regret a lot to have this piece. It's simply not true. It's a fabrication. It's a complete fabrication.
More than 59 million Turkish citizens, including 3 million expatriates, were eligible to vote in Sunday's election. Protests continuing over separating detained children and their illegal migrant parents at the U.S. border. President Trump has said open borders let in criminals like the MS-13 gang.
Our issue is strong borders, no crime. Their issue is open borders, let MS-13 all over our country. That's what's going to happen if you listen to them.
Mr. Trump says immigration is a good election issue for Republicans who are hoping the fall election to maintain control of Congress over the Democrats. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari calling for calm and vowing to bring about responsibility to justice in all for the nearly 90 people killed in an attack by suspected nomadic herders targeting farming communities. Clashes have left thousands dead in recent decades and threatened to inflame ethnic and religious tensions. This is VOA News. U.S. Defense Chief Jim Mattis will be visiting China this week amid growing tensions between Washington and Beijing over China's policy on the South China Sea, U.S. sales of arms to Taiwan, and a looming trade war. Mattis told reporters Sunday he wants to take measure of China's strategic ambitions as it increases its military positions in disputed areas of the South China Sea. Atlantic Council senior fellow Robert Manning tells VOA these meetings for Mattis come at a crucial time.
I think the proximity of U.S.-Chinese forces in the South China Sea has led to a number of near clashes. More recently, there were reports of Chinese using lasers to disrupt American planes. So I think there's a fundamental difference in norms and rules in terms of maritime behavior, and I think we need to sort those out.
Despite the thorny issue on the table, Mattis also hopes to secure China's support for pressuring North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons program, the key goal of the summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un earlier this month. Singapore has revised what it spent on that Trump-Kemp summit, reporting a tab of $12 million as opposed to an earlier report of nearly $15 million. Singapore Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong said most of the cost went toward the security for the two leaders. Lee said all of this cost is his country. He's willing to pay to contribute to a meeting that was in Singapore's profound interest. Saudi Arabia state media says the kingdom's air defenses have intercepted two ballistic missiles fired over the capital from Yemen, where Saudi-led coalition forces are at war. Yemen's Iranian-backed Houthi rebels have fired more than 100 missiles at Saudi Arabia in the last 3 years as the kingdom's carried out airstrikes against the group. This war has killed at least 10,000 Yemeni civilians. Meantime, U.S. aid agencies are ramping up humanitarian operations in Yemen's port city of Hodeidah. A spokesman for the U.N. Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Lerke, says his agencies are deeply worried about the civilians caught in the middle of the conflict.
If malnutrition support from humanitarian partners is disrupted, it risks the lives of almost 100,000 children. Hodeidah was also one of the epicenters of last year's cholera outbreak, one of the worst in modern history.
Port of Hodeidah is a vital lifeline for people throughout the country. And the entire police force in a western Mexican town, Ocampo, have been detained on suspicion of involvement in the murder of a mayoral candidate. So far, 100 politicians in this year's election have been murdered. I'm Steve Norman in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Monday, June the 25th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you. The government of Nigeria imposed a dusk to dawn curfew on Sunday in Central Plateau State. This was after 70 people died in communal clashes between farmers and semi-nomadic herders. And in Mali, the government and local sources say that at least 16 Fulani herders have been killed in suspected ethnic clashes in central Mali. In Zimbabwe, the vice president says that the explosion at a campaign rally for President Mnangagwa, an explosion that is said to have injured 49 people, will not delay next month's election. In Ethiopia, the health ministry says that a second person has died following the blast on Saturday at a political rally in the Ethiopian capital of Addis Ababa.
It's a big disappointment because people came out to celebrate love and togetherness, and a country that is trying to move forward after years of protest and years of turmoil. This should not have happened. But the city is, more or less back to normal according to people on the ground.
Mohamed Ademo is an Ethiopian journalist and political analyst. And in Gambia, major public demonstrations were held on Sunday against the government of President Adama Barrow. Human rights activists gathered to denounce the recent killings of three Gambian environmentalists by the country's police intervention unit.
Never again will the government voluntarily or involuntarily be indifferent to the suffering, to the voices, to the cries of the masses of our people. That to the young people of the Gambia, you have a historic responsibility before your people.
Aliyu Ba is a Gambian human rights activist who was speaking at a rally this past weekend. Those stories plus a World Cup update are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. The government of Nigeria imposed a dusk to dawn curfew on Sunday in Central Plateau State. This was after at least 70 people died in communal clashes between farmers and semi-nomadic herders. Reports say that strife in the decades-old conflict has escalated sharply this year, particularly in the ethnically and religiously diverse hinterland states known as the Middle Belt. And in Mali, communal violence between herders and farmers, which originated partly over dwindling fertile land, has spiraled into a cycle of violence and reprisal attacks that has killed hundreds of people this year in the Middle Belt. Government and local sources say that at least 16 Fulani herders have been killed in suspected ethnic clashes in the center of the country. And Ethiopia's health ministry says at least a second person has died following the blast Saturday at a political rally in the Ethiopian capital of Addis Ababa. Officials say 150 people were injured in the explosion. Ethiopia's new prime minister, Abiy Ahmed, had just finished a speech at the rally in the capital when a grenade exploded. Meanwhile, the Ethiopia state broadcaster says that at least 30 people, including the capital's deputy chief of police, have been arrested in connection with the blast. There's still a lot of speculation as to the people and the motive behind this attack, with speculation rife that elements within the ruling party were not happy with the pace of what many say are remarkable reforms under the new prime minister. For context on what is happening in Ethiopia, I reached Mohamed Ademo, an Ethiopian political analyst and editor, here in Washington, D.C.
It's a big disappointment because people came out to celebrate love and togetherness, and a country that is trying to move forward after years of protest and years of turmoil. This should not have happened. But the city is, more or less back to normal according to people on the ground and moving forward. And there have been, people were lining up today to donate blood to victims. And obviously there are a lot of people still recovering.
Do you have an idea who might want to cause harm or this kind of mayhem to people who were celebrating?
It's very difficult to, precisely pinpoint who might be behind this. But if you look at the pattern of change taking place in Ethiopia. There is a fast pace of change that is happening towards more democratization and opening up, and obviously not everyone is happy with that. And in this case, the establishment that had monopoly on security matters and were deeply involved in economic affairs and economic development, we're not happy with some of the actions that the new Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, is taking. Mm. And a lot of people, when the incident happened, quickly pointed their fingers at the establishment and the so-called the deep state. But also when you look at the people who have been arrested so far, up to 9 federal police officers, including the deputy commander of the Addis Ababa City Police Commission, was arrested. So it seems like they were arrested for the lax insecurity, and some people say, allege that they were suspected of even maybe giving cover. So I think investigation is ongoing. There is a lot of details here, and I think the Ethiopian people deserve some clarity as to what happened. And obviously these are very sensitive times, and the government should handle it very carefully, because if you blame whole ethnic group for this heinous crime, that could backfire and lead in another direction. So it is a very delicate matter that needs to be handled professionally. And so far, the government is being transparent about how many people are arrested, and the investigation is ongoing. But so far, the majority of Ethiopians think that the establishment, the deep state, is behind it.
So, Mohamed, there's been obviously lots of reforms undertaken by Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. Which one of these many reforms, either political or economic, which one do you think are more likely to incite this kind of pushback from the, whatever you called it, the deep state or the establishment?
I think generally the establishment is not happy with the direction in which the country is headed in the fast pace of change. And for example, let me give you 3 examples. The first one is when Andargachos Ege, the opposition leader with Gimbot 7, was released, the prime minister apparently made a comment, something to the effect that he fought tooth and nail to secure his release, and he faced opposition in doing that. And when the decision to normalize relations with Eritrea came down, even though the executive committee of the EPRDF, the ruling party, voted unanimously to restore or to normalize relations, the TPLF, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, came out with a statement, not necessarily opposing it, but sort of going around it to say that the prime minister was moving fast and he did not consult with the public properly, even though that was, you know, in a lot of people's mind, an oxymoron, because this is not a party that is known for transparency or getting people's input in decision-making. And thirdly, when TPLF issued its statement, one of the more remarkable things that they pointed out was that the old guard that was occupying seats and not doing much and abusing power, who were forced into retirement, should be honored. And they also suggested that the sort of reshuffle that is still ongoing within the executive branch, specifically I would think that the reshuffle within the security and intelligence apparatus, they were not happy with those decisions, and they felt that those decisions, even though the prime minister has the full power to appoint directors and people to government, they questioned those decisions. And it's clear that they're losing power and they wanted more input, more control over not just appointments of government officials, but also the direction in which the country is headed, which is that they would want to maintain the status quo, because the status quo benefits them.
Mohamed Ademu is an Ethiopian political analyst and editor. I reached him at his home here in Washington, D.C. A major public demonstration was held in The Gambia on Sunday against the government of President Adama Barrow. Human rights activists gathered to denounce the recent killings of three Gambian environmentalists by the country's police intervention unit. Protesters also decried what they called the growing culture of official corruption. For more on this, Pat Nderimbai has this report.
Power to the people!
Power to the people!
Power to the people!
The voices of Gambian protesters at the BC Westfield intersection. Westfield is located in Sharekunda, in the Kanifi municipality. It is about 11 kilometers from the capital city, Banjul. Human rights activists and Gambian rappers gathered to denounce what they call the culture of impunity in the country. One of them is Aliou Ba.
Never again will impunity reign in this country. Never again will the government voluntarily or involuntarily be indifferent to the suffering, to the voices, to the cries of the masses of our people. That to the young people of the Gambia, you have a historic responsibility before your people.
Ba calls for youth participation on issues affecting the country, including holding the government accountable. And Gambian rappers have responded to his challenge. They have released an anti-corruption and police brutality this song against the Barrow government.
Corruption, baby, be my neighbor.
Police brutality, be my neighbor.
No.
The indicting this song talks about the regime's alleged lack of environmental friendliness and disrespect for human rights. This followed the killing of three Gambian environmentalists in Faraba, where the Julake Engineering and Construction Company has been accused of environmental destruction. Lisa Yusin, a one-time Banjul mayoral candidate, also attended the protest march.
I stand in solidarity with the youth. I stand in solidarity with the women. I stand in solidarity with the children. I stand against the destruction of flora and fauna in our country. I stand against sand mining.
President Adama Barrow visited Faraba over the weekend to sympathize with the bereaved families. He has appealed for calm and reassured residents that his government is committed to human rights and the rule of law. Protester Madi Jobate wants the government to be more serious in tackling corruption.
The Gambia, we have an anti-corruption commission, 2012. Yeah, Gambia never set up the commission. These people came 1 year, 6 months, they have never set up that commission to fight against corruption. And corruption is the most insidious cancer that can erode our rights and, you know, erode our services.
The protest was self-styled, Dafadoy, in the world of dialect, meaning enough is enough. The organizers of the protest have issued a set of demands for the government, which include the training of Gambian security officers on human rights, providing financial compensation to the Faraba victims, and the repealing of the Public Order Act. The Public Order Act requires protesters to apply for a police permit before they could use a public address system in any protest march. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pan Derimbai reporting.
In Uganda, human rights activists are calling on the police to release an opposition member of parliament that has been in detention for more than 10 days. Activists say that parliamentarian Betty Nambozi's health is deteriorating and needs special treatment from abroad. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji files this report from Kampala, Uganda.
Medi Kagwa, who heads the Uganda Human Rights Commission, wrote the police last week asking them to release Nambozi from detention. Kagwa says it is her constitutional right to be released so as to seek medical treatment.
We've just said that the Nambozi is sick, they should let her get treatment. Her complaint was she's sick, she wants treatment, and that's what we responded to, because she's not under any charge as far as I know.
Nambozi was arrested in the aftermath of the death of ruling party member of parliament, Ibrahim Abiriga, who was murdered in Kampala by a known gunman. She had been released on police bond, but was rearrested after the president made statements saying he will not tolerate police bond and bail for murder suspects. Some religious leaders and opposition politicians have criticized Nambo's continued detention beyond the 48-hours rule that is provided for by the Ugandan constitution. Police spokesperson Emiliane Kaima insists the police is just doing its job.
She was summoned again to do an additional statement, which she did, and in the middle of it all, she claimed her health was deteriorating. And the best option, as we have always been trained and as we do, was to think of life first. So we took her to the hospital, to Chirundu Hospital, where she's receiving medication. She's in the hands of professionals.
Kampala Mayor and Nambo's lawyer, Erias Rukwago, will come to human rights later, asking the police to release the opposition politician.
My only prayer is that the powers that be, and specifically the police and other government agencies, comply with the directive as given by the Chairman of the Human Rights Commission, so that they, we give priority to the life of Honorable Nambo, so that she can regain freedom, she can proceed to India and secure specialized treatment. And thereafter, if there are any charges you want to prefer against Honorable Nambose, it is at their discretion.
Rukwago says Nambose was supposed to travel to India on 15th of this month. Nambose is currently under police surveillance at the hospital room. She is alleged to have posted on social media saying parliamentarians such as the late Abiriga, who championed the removal of age limits from the constitution, will be punished by the aggrieved members of the public. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
And campaigners are arguing Australia to do more to stop forced marriages in its migrant communities. Since the practice was made illegal 5 years ago, more than 230 alleged cases have been referred to the Australian Federal Police, but there have been no prosecutions. From Sydney, Phil Masser has this report.
Since forcing an individual to marry was criminalised in Australia in March 2013, there have been no successful prosecutions. The police say that doesn't reflect the work they do to successfully prevent or disrupt forced marriages. Campaigners say most victims are girls under the age of 18, but many are unwilling to go to the authorities, fearing isolation or retribution from their families and communities. There's also a reluctance to speak to the police or start a criminal case against a relative or friend. Jennifer Byrne, the director of Anti-Slavery Australia, a campaign organisation, says the true scale of the problem is unknown.
I have no doubt that there are many more in the community who are unidentified, who are either in a forced marriage or facing a forced marriage.
Bial Daraj ran away from her home in Australia after two older sisters were forced to travel to Iraq to marry.
Seeing what they were going through really terrified me, and I didn't want to experience it. I argued as much as I can, stalled as much as I can, and then around 15, I just had enough and ran away because I knew, like, within a week I would have been married if I'd stayed at home.
Earlier this year, the Australian government announced a year-long trial to make it easier for victims to get help. Under the project, they can seek support without the involvement of the police. The government in Canberra states that forced marriage is a slavery-like practice, a form of gender-based violence and an abuse of human rights. Britain introduced a similar law to outlaw forced marriages in 2014, where the first prosecution has just finished. In Australia, this type of crime has affected women and girls from migrant Middle Eastern communities and others from Bangladesh, Afghanistan, India and Pakistan. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Zimbabwe's vice president says that the explosion at a campaign rally for President Mnangagwa will not delay next month's election. State media called Saturday's blast in Bulawayo an assassination attempt. Zimbabwe's police said that there is an ongoing investigation and a substantial reward will be offered for information. Video footage showed President Mnangagwa walking off the stage after a rally and into a crowded tent where the blast occurred seconds later. Zimbabwe's main opposition leader, Nelson Chamisa, condemned the attack. And now for some World Cup update from Samson O'Malley. Good morning, Samson.
Good morning to you, Jackson. We'll begin with the summary of actions on match day 11 at the 2018 FIFA World Cup here in Russia. Senegal missed the chance to put themselves in a good position to qualify for the round of 16 as they were forced to a 2-2 draw by Japan in Group H of the Russia 2018 FIFA World Cup on Sunday. Both teams are now on 4 points after two games, with Senegal facing Colombia in their final group game, while Japan will take on Poland, both on Thursday. I spoke to some journalists covering the World Cup here in Moscow. This is what they had to say about Senegal's performance.
I think this result, 2-2 draw, makes the group very interesting because, as you know, Japan beat Colombia 2-1 in the first match. Senegal beat Poland by a similar scoreline in the first match, in their first match of the group. So it means both teams are level on 4 points, same goal aggregate. Number of goals scored and number of goals conceded is the same. So this result makes the group very exciting.
Well, I think it's not such a good result for Senegal, but I'm sure they are happy that they have avoided a defeat in this game.
I mean, you don't take the lead twice and give the lead away. Then if you are not able to defend, you have no business at the World Cup. If it, unfortunately, Senegal get eliminated from the tournament, and they will look back to this game with a lot of disappointment, and they will have to know that their campaign ended in this particular game here. At this level, we've got to be able to understand how to defend, how to keep your lines, how to run down the clock.
Senegal star forward Sadio Mane claimed the Budweiser Man of the Match award after getting on the score sheet in Sunday's 2-2 draw against Japan in Group H of the Russia 2018 FIFA World Cup. In the other game, Harry Kane netted a hat-trick as England trashed Panama 6-1 in an emphatic victory in the World Cup Group G at the Nizhny Novgorod Stadium. Gareth Southgate's side scored 5 times in an astonishing first-half display, with Panama simply unable to compete. Harry Kane was voted as the man of the match.
I feel great. I feel good. Obviously, buzzing from the game. Amazing result, 6-1. Just delighted, obviously, through. That was our goal. That was our target. With one game to spare, so we just got to enjoy this moment.
The third and final group matches have been slated for today, Monday the 25th of June 2018, across various venues. In Group A, Uruguay will meet the host nation Russia at the Cosmos Samara Arena, while Kingdom of Saudi Arabia will be looking forward to salvage some national pride when they meet Egypt in the dead rubber encounter. In Group B, at the Moldova Arena, Iran will play Portugal, while Spain will trade tackle with Morocco, which is a face-off between the top and bottom of the group at the Kaliningrad Stadium. Spain need a draw to guarantee that they progress to the knockout stages. Meanwhile, Morocco are already down and out. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in St. Petersburg, Russia. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you very much, Samson. And that's it for this Monday, June 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good morning, Africa.
Hello, I'm Lino Mdou, host of Health Chat. Next week on the program, we'll have part two of our discussion on albinism, a congenital disorder characterized by the complete or partial absence of pigment in the skin, hair, and eyes. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Chat, this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, decentralized systems of governments in Africa. In Uganda, it's called decentralization. In Kenya, devolution. in Nigeria and Ethiopia, it's called federalism. The transfer of authority from central to local government on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.